Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 273 featuring Alberto Miago, who is a fabulous director, a really creative person, and you may have seen his work if you ever watched any of the Love, Death, and Robots, especially The Witness. It's an incredible piece, right, Kristen?
Oh, loved it. Yeah, it was really good. Mesmerizing.
Mesmerizing, right?
Yeah.
He's a very interesting person because really, I mean, his talents are all over the place. But he's very talented as a painter as well. And that painting style that he did is very, very prominent in obviously The Witness and a lot of the other work that he has been doing as well. And he actually did have a big part to do with the early parts of Spider-Man Enter the Spider-Verse, and that style definitely comes through in that process. What are some of your thoughts about it?
Well, it was nice because first, I mean, I've watched a few Love, Death, and Robots, but I listened to this podcast first and then watched his episode. And it was fun just seeing all like the little techniques he talked about. He called it, I think it was the cloth technique, and how he tried to get that like so delicate, and how it like, he says, catching light in a softer way to create a gentle experience for like the viewer. And just knowing that like made me appreciate it so much more.
Yeah, absolutely. And just from what's interesting about him is that even though he's very sort of creative and analog in a lot of ways to what he does, but he also goes extremely technical.
Yeah.
Like if anyone's ever done anything in terms of cloth simulation or been a character effects person, he pulled off the hardest thing you could ever pull off in animation, which is someone doing cloth simulation while putting on a shirt.
Yeah.
And if you look at the thing, that is like the holy grail of cloth simulation, is putting on a shirt, and they pull it off. It's incredible. It looks amazing. But it was a really great thing to have him on. He's a very charismatic person. Colorful language, just for those of you who are concerned about his language. He's got very colorful language, but I love the guy. He's a wonderful person and very inspirational. Some of the other things you liked about him, what was that, Kristen?
I liked in The Witness how he kind of made it. It was his personal experiences is kind of how the whole thing came around, where it was like a loop. He's like, it's just, and it's all any type of toxic relationship. It's almost addicting. So that was interesting. And then he says that the woman also represents like, you know, Snake and temptation. So it was really fun. I mean, I probably could have picked that up watching it, but it was just nice listening to this first and then going back and then rewatching it.
Right.
It's just,
yeah. I definitely recommend you watch it first and then listen to the podcast and then watch it again.
Yes.
it's not very long. The podcast is definitely longer than the description, but it's really cool to hear that process as well. And his concepts of the animation and what animation could be, and why does it have to always be about kids, and why can't animation be its own art form? And there's a lot of stuff he goes through. I'm not going to spoil it too much, but it was really great.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun to talk to him about that stuff. All right, we got a couple of announcements that we want to make sure people know about.
Yes.
Before we do that, just because it's hot off the wire, I want to let people know that there's a blog post about how we're recording these podcasts remotely. Right, Kristen?
Yeah. Good to see some photos of us.
Yeah. So if you guys go to our blog section at chaoscoop.com, you'll check out a little blog about how Kristen and I have been managing to make these podcasts still happen and be better than ever because of what we've been able to do. So go check that out on our blog section if you want to know more about that. It's been working out really well. But what are some of the other announcements we have?
All right. So we've brought these up the last few weeks, but I'm going to talk about them one more time. So we have the Education Collection, which is out now. This includes all V-Ray products except Katana and Nuke. And it's only $150 a year. So you can go to chaosgroup.com/V-Ray/education-collection to find out more.
Right. And that's really kind of a really great deal. If you have if you're basically in school or an educator, you can get all of V-Ray products with the only exceptions of V-Ray for Katana and V-Ray for Nuke for $150 a year, which is an amazing deal. And that includes Phoenix as well. So Phoenix for Maya, Phoenix for Max, V-Ray for Unreal, V-Ray for Revit, like just a ton of products. So it's a really great deal. And we have a couple more too. What else do we have?
Yes, so we have the V-Ray Personal Learning Edition for Maya that came out last week, I believe it was.
Right. And that is for anyone. You don't need to be in school to get that. Anyone can get the PLE version of V-Ray for Maya, which has a few restrictions, but pretty much if you want to use V-Ray to learn by yourself or do it for any non-commercial products or projects, you are totally welcome to use our V-Ray PLE version, and that is 100% free. So pretty good deal as well. One more, of course, we're trying to help people out as they're sitting at home and trying to finish their projects and may not have access to a big farm close by. What can we do for them?
So we have the cloud discount, and this will be the last week it is offered. It ends in at the end of April. So you can render at home with no bundles, and the credits are good for 3 months after purchase, but you must purchase before the end of April. And you can find out more about this at www.chaosgroup.com/cloud.
That's right. We're offering basically our maximum discount on any number of cloud credits that you want to buy. So we're really trying to make sure that people can get through this hump and be able to do their projects while they're sitting at home. And that would be a really good discount and help for them as well. Especially if you're using your, you're trying to do your personal projects and you've always wanted to get it done and you have a little time now, get it done on V-Ray Cloud. We'd love to be able to help you out there. Great. And now, of course, we're getting towards the end. Where can people find out more about the podcast?
So you can go to facebook.com/cggaragepodcast or chaosgroup.com/cggarage.
Perfect. And if you guys have any ideas or feedback that you'd like to give us, you can always email us labs@chaosgroup.com. That's labs@chaosgroup.com. And of course, we're always looking for some great, feedback from you guys on, we'd love a rating or any kind of reviews of us. So if you're on Apple Podcasts, please make sure to rate us, review us, and share us with your friends on Apple Podcasts. All right, that being said, please enjoy this fabulous podcast with Alberto Miego.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Normally we'll do them in person, but this is what I have to do. Even though you're in LA. You're in LA now, right?
I'm in LA now, yes.
Yeah, what you doing in LA? Just living here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been here for 10 years. It's
Yeah.
just that for the last maybe 3 years, I've been kind of like going a little bit more back and forth between Spain and here.
Yeah.
I happen to find a really cool team of people in Spain, so most of my latest projects, I produce them there.
Yeah. Well, that is really cool. At the first time I met you was at THU,
Yes.
and I, which was a lot of fun. I always go there. It's my Mecca. I go there every year.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Your talk was very, very good. It was very, very funny because that's the kind of person you are.
Wow. I'm
But
older now. I'm older now.
yeah, but I think you also have a really good perspective on creativity and the realities of creativity and how to be, how to make the most out of yourself, creatively speaking. But what would be really cool is to, some people know of your work. Obviously, it's been very big recently, which is great. But some people may not necessarily know about you and how you got to be the person that you are and the passions that you have and your painting and all that stuff. What
Right.
can you tell people a little bit about how you started, how you sort of figured out your creative role and what made you that the person you are today?
Okay. Yeah, I mean it's a very long story. I don't know if we have the time. I mean I can make it short. I remember I was very young. I didn't even know how to read. And my father was reading these comic books It was these comic books that I actually happened to win in some sort of like a drawing contest or something like that. And they gave me this little comic book from Tintin or Tantan. I'm not too sure how you guys pronounce it.
Yeah.
And which happened to be one of my very favorite comics ever. And I grew up with it. And I remember that day my father was pointing out each panel and telling me what was happening in the panels, basically reading out loud.
He was reading it for you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember I didn't know how to read, you know. That was kind of like the clue that told me, okay, you don't know how to read at that time. And I remember back then deciding like, wow, I want to do comic books myself. Like I have it that clear. And then since then, I was basically just trying. But it's been really like a whole roller coaster, you know, like this industry goes up and down, and I've been going through a lot of companies, a lot of cool times, difficult times, but always with the passion of doing what I like to do, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right now, actually, it's very tough. We don't really know where things are going.
We don't know. You don't know. It's true.
We don't
know. Let's put a historical context. We are in the middle of a pandemic. disaster. Yeah, it's pretty dramatic, obviously for a lot of people, and it's very confusing for the ones that is not that dramatic. It's really strange time.
It's true, but I think also this is a time where there is going to be a lot of the idea of storytelling and content is not going to go away.
It's true. It's true. I mean, especially if I have to talk for animation, we are now, I'm in the middle of preparing the next project and we are starting in the cloud. So we are basically working, and we always are anyway. We, even if I have a base studio in Madrid, maybe let's say like 40% of the crew is elsewhere. In Canada, there is a lot of people. Or sometimes even in Australia. It's just like animation is that flexible, fortunately. Yeah.
That's actually a really good thing. So we can talk about a little bit about the technology, but let's talk a little bit about your animation and your passion for animation. How did, obviously you mentioned comic books as one thing, but, you know, when we look at The Witness, for example, we can definitely see an influence in comic books that happens in your style. And you know, some of the, obviously a lot of the other work that you've done, but how did you get involved in animation, and what's your idea of animation?
Well, animation, I think that the same passion that I had with these comic books, it happened to me when I started watching all those Disney classics. Like, even though a lot of people, they told me that I'm sort of like an anti-Disney or whatever, which is not true. I mean, what happened is that my style perhaps is a little bit more target. The audience is more for adult, and Disney is not. But I love Disney. I mean, the history of Disney for me is where it keeps me. Is the reason why I'm here as well. I remember when I was watching The Aristocats or 101 Dalmatian, I was like, geez, what the fuck is this? And I wanted to know how to do it. And I was doing a lot of failure attempts at home. Like I was just trying to basically... actually, I also have this machine that it was in Spain. It was called Cinexin, which it was like a orange box that you put a tape and then you roll it. I don't know how you guys call it in America, but it was also very nice because it has Disney pieces there, and you can see frame by frame because you can actually decide the speed that you want it, and you project it in the wall. You know.
So it was basically like a manual projector.
It's a manual projector, and you have different like cassettes that you put there, and it has little Disney shorts.
I remember those things. Yeah,
that was amazing. And it gave me, I guess that gave me a little bit of like a sense of frames and a sense of speed. Yep. So I remember that I was playing a lot, like going further and going backwards, you know, because you can actually do that. And it was, it was so, so amazing to have that. And then I jump into cinema and my obsession with cinema in general. And I've been watching a lot of films from everywhere. And then I apply film into animation. I don't apply animation into animation. I think that I have a little bit more knowledge in cinema in general. And I think, sorry, let me just correct myself. I think I apply more live action and cinema in general than animation itself.
Okay. Why is that?
I feel that, you know, I feel that there is like better examples that I like in the world of cinema live action than in the world of animation. I mean, it's
okay.
I have
is
a lot
because
of.
Is it because the stories are being told? Is
yeah,
it,
stories and cameras and, you know.
But there's no reason why you can't have, you know, stories that are live action
there
stories
no,
in animation.
There is no. I mean, nowadays we are improving that. And I think that we are having more and more specific and target stories. Like we can do horror films, we can do dramas, we can do, you know, films about war, everything. We are very flexible, we can do everything. But for some reason, I guess it's because Pixar and Disney formula, it was very successful. And it kind of like very much, it took the entire industry, you know, it was so successful that it was even it's even difficult sometimes for the general audience to differentiate what is a Disney or what is a Pixar or what is a DreamWorks in terms of a story and in terms of the look. And I think that is now time, and I think that the audience is ready to actually explore different storytellings and also different looks. It's sad that a technology that is so flexible and a technology that can depict so much, which is 3D, you know, you can invent.
It's become pigeonholed.
Exactly. It's almost like all of the, all their rabbits, they look the same rabbit, and all their deers, they look the same deers. It's just a little bit frustrating. But it makes sense. It was a very successful business. So why change it?
Yeah, but it's also, you know, it was always, I mean, this is going on since the 40s or 30s, you know? It was always, they were called cartoons, right? They were for the kids.
Yeah, it's true.
And it was, there was no reason why it needed to be for the kids, but that's what they saw. It's like, oh, kids like to draw. They like drawings. We'll make moving drawings. And that's the animation. And then it became the stereotype forever.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously different. They've been, well, you know, obviously heavy metal was one of the first ones that sort of like showed that it could do something a little more adult.
Or, I mean, but even before, I mean, you have, yeah. What was the name? I mean, the first cartoons, they were not strictly for kids. And some of them, they were pretty adult. Like, I mean, if you look the original Popeye or even if Betty Boop.
Betty Blue, yeah.
It was definitely, that was not for kids.
Pretty racy.
Yeah. I know, but it was very sexual and, you know, right. a very sexy character. That it was very much trying to arouse. And so it was not, originally it was not created for kids.
Right.
I think it was just like it was successful at some point. And I have to say something that is different from the movies back in the time and the movies now. Nowadays, I don't have kids, but I see parents that they take their kids to the movies nowadays and then they have their kid obsessed with the toys and they want to own every single toy and every single piece of merchandising. If I have a kid and I take my kid to the cinema and after the movie, my kid is on and on and on, like, I want this merchandising, I want this toy, I will be very suspicious. I will be like, this is weird and this is manipulation. It's strange because in the previous movies, I remember 101 Dalmatians or the Aristocats or the other kind of movies where kids, you want to be them or you want to be with them, with those characters, but you don't want to own them. There is no this feeling of possession, I think, that there is nowadays in these movies. And I don't know what it is. It's a strange manipulation, weird maneuver.
But it's also with adults.
Yes.
You know? You're seeing, and especially now, you know, especially starting with around Gen X, adults were still willing to buy merchandise.
Yeah.
Of, you know, mm-hmm. you don't see that in obviously in, you know, the baby boomers are not going out there and buying, you know, the latest Hellboy figurine, right?
No, it's true.
but we are Gen X people are. You go to any animator's desk and it's filled with toys a lot of times.
It's true. We are so weird.
We are like, and it's just this collectible thing, and I don't understand. Yeah, it's not me. I don't necessarily have a bunch of collectibles. I like t-shirts. For some reason t-shirts is okay with me.
Nice.
But I don't. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't. It's not a. It's true though. You're right. There is a merchandise and a aspect of it, a commercial aspect to animation that's very different. And it's true that it's mostly in animation and comic book content. You're not, you know, you're not seeing a Sophie's Choice figurine, right?
No, exactly. That's actually something that I really would like to do. I would like to take animation into that level, into a level that it doesn't need to be merchandised and it doesn't need to be collectible. I would like to make, my dream is to make a film that can be, an animation film that can be considered best picture.
Best picture.
Yeah, for example.
Overall,
like you don't say best black and white film or best color film. So I would like to do a film that is so good that people is like, wow, I don't care about the technique. This is visually incredible and the story is really nice and engaging.
Right. Yeah, but there is, I mean, obviously, you know, there's in the Western culture, it still takes a long time to overcome that that stigma. But obviously with Miyazaki, you know, even films like Akira back in the day, these are films that are very powerful, very strong, that were very interesting as well. Do you think that there's something that we can learn from that type of content or those types of stories?
I mean, yeah. I mean, personally, even Satoshi Kon, like there is like a number of movies coming from Japan and even from Korea in animation that they are like masterpieces, and they take animation into a level, into a very serious level that in the Western we are starting to take now. But the thing is that sometimes they are not very easy to translate. Not in the language, I mean also the attitude and
the culture.
Yeah. Even when you watch, I love the films of Wong Kar-wai, for example. But it's for a specific people that they like cinema or that they like that kind of film. But for the general audience, it's a different rhythm. The way that they talk is differently. Even the stories that they tell, it feels that they come from a different world. Which is what I find fascinating, but it's perhaps that's why is anime, and unless you are a big fan of anime is not reaching out as much people as, for example, a Pixar or something like that. But actually, sorry to your question, if we have something to learn, I think mostly the respect for cinema and the respect for animation is something that definitely these guys take super far.
Now, it's what's also interesting is that, you know, because I had been talking to Tim Miller for years about this, right? And he's been on the podcast several times, actually, and we discussed it.
Nice.
And I remember, like, the very first podcast I did with him, and that was probably 5 or 6 years ago. You know, he was in the middle of post-production on Deadpool, right? And that was a film that would never have gotten made because of that stigma. Superhero films are not R-rated, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. And he did, right? Obviously, now there's a lot of R-rated superhero films. But then he was telling me at that time, he's like, I've the same conversation we're just having. It's like, I don't know why we can't make animation that's geared for adults, R-rated content. And so he had the idea of Love, Death, and Robots for years. And it wasn't until the success of Deadpool that Netflix said, go for it. You know?
Yeah.
And I think he found some really great content, really good people to do it. And I really love the variety, the variety of stuff that you got out of that, and styles and genre, you know, comedy and drama and all these different things. There's obviously a lot of people talk about The Witness. There's a lot of stuff about it.
Mm.
It's a beautiful piece. It's a beautiful execution. It's a great story. It's a great style. But I know that a lot of people are going to sit here, and there's been stories about it, but I'd love to have you say it on the podcast. How did you do that? First of all, let's talk about what the story is and where that idea came from.
Right.
But then you have to tell people about how it was done, how it was pulled off.
Okay. Well, the story is very much a relationship in a way. It's a relationship that I was at the time involved, and is one of those relationships that are like really stormy, really dramatic, and that everybody had them. You know, those relations where you maybe it's very much based on sex and temptation, and you should leave it. You see red lights everywhere. This is not going anywhere. Stop it. And then both characters, they end up being a victim. So it's a constant loop, you know, you come back to those relationships again and then you fuck again or whatever, you come back right. Somehow. And then you harm yourself and you harm the other person. So very much it was The Witness is that. That's why there is like this interesting nightclub that is very sexual. That's why the girl is wearing this very long dress, because she's kind of like representing the snake and the scene, which is basically the biggest representation of temptation for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when we were doing the animation reference, I was asking the dancer, the girl that was doing the reference, like, don't take the dress with your hands, like wrap yourself as a snake is changing her skin. So when she's dancing, she's not using the hands ever. She's basically rubbing herself in the sofa in order to take the dress out, which end up being pretty arousing experience. You know, I think it's the final result. It was so personal that I think that people felt it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very much what the story is about, but it's a thriller, you know, so for a lot of people,
yeah.
It's basically a thriller, but I like to, it's funny because a lot of people, they say, I don't like to explain, I don't remember who it was. It's a very big director. Somebody says like, I don't like to explain my movies because I think that is like an obscene thing or whatever. But sometimes it's nice to explain. I think it's good to give your own vision and your own take on the story.
Sure.
How is it done? Well, it's more simple as people think. It's basically,
I think that's what's so cool about it.
it's the same way that Bambi was done. I mean, it's basically a painting, okay, and a character running on top of it. So we were doing a lot of paintings, so a lot of it is not 3D. We live in a world of 3D that, you know, people generate everything in 3D. They generate environments, they generate windows, doors, floors. And for this film, we only did three full 3D scenes that they were not even 3D. They were basically paintings, sort of like in a collage, displayed, you know, in angles. So we could move cameras there. But most of it's
projected of some kind or just planes.
Exactly.
Right?
Some sort of projection, some stuff. Like there is some scenes that I did by myself in After Effects. And then there are some other scenes that a friend of mine, which is artistically is called Heavy Poly, he did it himself as well with his painting. Like in a way of, it's not even projection. It's basically you just get the painting and then put it in an angle and that's it.
Mm.
And that's for the environment.
That's for the environment.
We obviously,
but you painted all the stuff yourself, all the environments.
Oh, well, I paint a big amount of them. But we were three people painting. Actually, we end up having the help of two more people. So let's say that we were five artists painting the environments.
Wow. Mm. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So the way that I did it, I went to Hong Kong and then I spent 5 days. It was like a whole marathon of photos going up, down, getting inside buildings. Like Hong Kong is open. You can actually access almost everything. And I was like sneaking in places. And I had a very crazy story that is a little bit long, but dude, it's a crazy story about what happened in Hong Kong. But anyway, I was taking a lot of reference and then we were painting based on the reference. So I went there, I was planning the shots, I was planning the action in the location. Yep. And that's something that I like to do always. I was working in this commercial that is also based in London, and I did the same. I went there, and then it's cool to go on location because you can figure the action, you can place your cameras, and then basically do a lot of painting. So far is that. And then for the 3D, we were doing key animation, so we were doing a lot of reference with several cameras. And we gave it to the animators, and then we have this incredible team of animators that they are, you know, very pure into realism, and that's the way that they like to work, and that's the animation that I like as well. Something like what you can actually see also in going back to Aristocats, or you know how
But you did. So, but they used reference. So they used some kind of rotomation of some kind, right?
We use two cameras reference. So the artists, they can see different angles of how they how the body moves. It's basically what the nine old men, perhaps they were doing back in the time in Disney. So it's basically how animators they
Snow
animate.
White was.
Not in Snow White. I mean, like more like I mean, I've seen a lot of videos of animation reference, like you know, Milk Cult and all these, or the Nine Old Men. They were animating pretty realistic, but in a way they were having the freedom of animation that you can exaggerate parts and you can take, you can be a little bit more free. But it's very much the same way that all my friends at Disney or my friends in DreamWorks. That's how they animate, they take a lot of reference of themselves, they act in front of the camera. The thing that I think that tricked the mind for a lot of people is that when you see a good animation in Pixar, a film, or in a Disney film, it almost like, it's like, oh my God, that rabbit is talking so realistic, right? It's like the rabbit really means what he's saying. It's really like the animator did such a good job. In The Witness, the difference is that we actually use realistic proportions. So then all of a sudden, it becomes extra real, right? So I guess that perhaps is that. And the cloth, I think that the cloth also did a lot.
The cloth, right. So there's a couple of things I want to get into. Because obviously, you know, what's interesting about it is that you are representing humans and you are showing humans, right? And they are people that are, you know, expressing, et cetera, et cetera. You are not shading them realistically, right? You're shading them in a different way that matches the style of your paintings and your backgrounds. And I'm assuming you used special shaders for that to give it the look to match everything to do it correctly. But what's interesting is that while it's very, very realistic, somehow you were right on the, you know, you could have been in the uncanny valley, but somehow something that you did, whether, you know, what do you think helped you avoid it? Obviously, the realism of the animation is really good, but it's really hard for people to make humans look real. Otherwise, we would see more of it.
Yeah.
But we don't, right? So what do you think are some of the successes that allowed you to do it? I mean, I know your animators are extremely good, and clearly they are, but you must have been some other things that help you make sure not to really get into the uncanny valley there. What do you think some of those things are?
Well, I think that obviously the style, even though the proportions, they were realistic, the characters, as you are saying, they were much more, the shading, it was much more graphic. But the same as the painting, like one of the rules that I have in this show, and I told to the animators, I told to the artists that they were also doing paintings, even to the modeler, we were saying, let's think about impressionism, right? Impressionism, basically, if you define it very quick, is what your eye can, what you can see with the hint of an eye, right? Is that, does it sound okay? Okay, so you look at something fast and that's what you're going to represent. My painting and my art is always based on that. So if you get closer into the paintings, you can see that it's not so detailed. It's very abstract, in fact. So the eye doesn't need all that information. We don't need all that information in order to complete an image. Because when we are... I mean, right now I'm looking at this video that we have in front of us, and I'm not looking at the window. I'm not looking at everything. Probably I'm not looking entirely at you. I'm sometimes looking at your right eye or sometimes at your left eye. That means that all the information that I am not actually looking at is almost useless, and it can be represented in a very graphic and simple way. So. If you can do that with painting, you can also do that with characters. Yes, get rid of things that they are not important, like veins, pores, skin details, very detailed hairs, eyelashes. There is a lot of things that they are really not important in a graphic impressionistic way, world. And the same for modeling. I was always constantly referring to mannequins or to Barbies, you know, like let's go for simple surface that they catch light in a softer way. I think that's the goal always. And then when everything is cohesive, you know, when things are not so complex in detail, then it's a gentle experience for the eye, I believe.
Yeah. Well, that's, I agree. I just want to hear from what you have to say. I've been obsessed with digital humans for a long time. And I was sort of like, this is very interesting because there's always these different levels, right, of how you can see things. And I always kind of remind people that the uncanny valley, there are two sides to the valley, right? When you have to get super hardcore realistic just to make sure that people are convinced, but then you can be just on the other side. And it'd still be very compelling, right? And so what you're doing is you're removing so much of the detail, but you're keeping all the other realism in other ways, right? The realism comes from the proportions, comes from the motion, comes from the all of the other things. And you don't need the micro skin detail that you get from a physical scan of a person.
Correct. You don't need.
So I think, my video keeps going in and out, but you don't see any of my pores here, right?
No.
But what it can do is that you represented other things that are very interesting. So I found it fascinating that you got a lot of those details of the humans and proportions. You mentioned the cloth. The cloth was amazing. So did you guys do the cloth? And obviously, cloth is almost a character in this story, which I also found amazing, especially her trying to escape in that situation, and her vulnerability through that cloth is so thin.
Yes.
And so the thing that's did you guys do cloth simulations from it? Did you use reference from it? How did you do that?
Okay, so for years, I saw. I love fashion, and I personally think that when you do character design, you need to think about what this character is wearing and why she's or he is choosing to wear this clothes, because that defines the character. And I've seen in the industry, I always seen a lack of fashion and a lack of of love for cloth use, and most of the times, and then let's be fair, is because it's a technology that it hasn't been explored and it usually gives a lot of problems. Like cloth simulation is usually very problematic. And long time ago, I mean, even much before The Witness, I remember seeing the first Marvelous Designer videos and sort of like simulations online, and I was like, shit, that's cool. There is also,
but it was also designed for the fashion.
It was designed exclusively for fashion, but their dynamics and the physics that they put behind, they were so good that, you know, people like me, for example, they say like, fuck, let's start doing something and apply it into animation. But I mean, a lot of people, they did it before me anyway. So I was basically inspired. And I also experienced that in animation, we always have a lot of problems with rigging, how an elbow bends, how a shoulder deforms. You know, there is a lot of corrective shapes that we can apply nowadays, but it's been always a problem. You know, it's like all these muscles. We are such a complex, speaking about realism, right? And the uncanny valley, the eye is so picky and so perfectionist. And when we see that something is working slightly different as we usually expect humans to behave, we catch it very, 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 very soon. So
that's our defense mechanism, actually.
Is it?
Yeah, because I have a whole talk about this. I've done many talks about visual humans.
Oh, wow.
When you're a child, when you're a baby, the first thing, like when my daughter was born, the first thing she does is stare at me in the face, right? So she studies the face. That's the first thing you learn as an infant. You look at your mother, your father, you just look for two eyes and a nose, right? And that's how you understand the face. And you learn the face and what a normal face looks like. If something doesn't look normal or slightly off, that is when babies cry, because they're scared of death, right? So that's when they look at that's why people always go ooh, doo, 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 like this to babies, because they won't want them to be scared. But if you went like this to a baby, it would freak out, right? Because then it would be a thing. So that progresses later in life to become like your survival thing. And speaking of, you know, coronavirus, if someone looks slightly sick, you are like, stay away.
Yeah, of course.
Right? So the uncanny valley is exactly that. If something looks not quite alive, your mind goes, death, sickness, zombie, you know, whatever. So that's what causes the repulsion, is because you think something is not quite right. Especially if it's close enough to human that it should be human. But if it's not, then you don't have to worry about it. Cause like, well, I don't buy that. So don't worry about it.
Wow. So yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, when you see an elbow that it bends strange, you are like, oh, that looks very weird. Combining these two things, you know, my love for fashion, my love of, like, I actually realize that I am obsessed about how cloth moves in general. Like, I'm very much into dynamics right now, like not only for cloth, like any sort of dynamic. I find it fascinating in 3D. And it's a cool way of covering a lot of mistakes, you know, like if you put a little bit of cloth on top and it moves nice and moves organically. So we were trying several options. We were trying end cloth. We were trying, I don't even remember, but back in the time we were trying some things, and we were actually trying a very complicated shot that everybody was telling me that's going to be impossible, which is when the girl, sorry, there is a helicopter. It's going to be recorded. That's fine, right?
Yeah, that's fine. Everyone knows we're dealing with hard times. We can deal with a helicopter.
Well, LA has helicopters even in the happiest times. But there is this scene where the girl actually dressed with the jacket in the corridor. She actually pulls the jacket in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the most difficult things to do in 3D. And we were trying and trying, and it was impossible, impossible. So I always wanted to do Marvelous Designer, and I wanted to push for Marvelous Designer. And I had so many people telling me, like, no, it's not going to work. The body of work that you want to do is not going to work. So I wanted to push. I wanted to push. And my friend Hide at the time, he was the head of characters. He was doing all the rigging. We were doing some tests with Marvelous Designer. We were always getting stuck in the part where the girl was getting the sleeve inside. But we
That's like the classic problem of cloth sim, yeah. is like putting a shirt on is like impossible.
But we did it.
Yeah, we did it.
But the thing is that we were trying and then at some point we needed help. So our friend Fernando, he was a head of layout. He had a friend, which is called Diego Conte, who is the brain behind the Marvelous Designer in my projects now. And we brought him in, and he's a very talented kid, and he didn't know too much about the program at the time, or at least as much as he know. And we more or less explained him what we were doing, and he took like a week to speed up and to understand the program and everything. And then he come up with a system, and we did it. And now, I keep working with Diego, and we were doing another of my shorts, the windshield wiper. He had also Diego and his team, they were doing it, and also a commercial that we just finished, like a 4 minutes commercial. And we were basically doing like very complex cloth simulation there as well, with a lot of fashion Amazing. And things. So that's, I'm going to keep doing it because I love it. I think that it looks very nice, and we can design amazing clothes. You know, you can even imagine like a brand.
Right. Well, I think so that was the thing. The thing that's amazing to me about the short is that you use the tools that you had, and you can get as analog or as technical as possible, right? You went from just painting abstract environments to full cloth simulation at the highest, most complicated level,
yes.
all shoved into the same content, all while telling a story that is completely compelling. It's quite a feat.
Wow.
I was really, really impressed. And you know, people still talk to me about it to this day. And it's like, how did they do it? And I was like, you know, I think there was a lot of just getting it done.
Yes.
Just get it done. But also you weren't overanalyzing things. You used a technology when it was appropriate, and then you just kept going with the rest of it as you needed to. That's the way it seems to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a lot of things that there is a lot of mistakes that cloth, they were like, for example, like, oh my God, it was a fuck up, and it was not working. And then I repaint frame by frame in many occasions because we have problems with the hair exploding or like doing a lot of things. And it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to re-render things, or you're going to erase. Like, there's a lot of things that you can do. You can manipulate frames. It's almost like an obsession of making everything in 3D from scratch. But there is a lot of things that you can mix. You can cheat. You can, you know, animation is an illusion. It's what it's supposed to be. I think that 3D is breaking a little bit that.
Right.
I think that we still is still doing the frame by frame illusion. Is this amazing book, The Illusion of Life, right? The Disney, the super thick book, and that's it. It's a trick. It needs to be a trick.
Yeah, and I think it's okay to paint.
Absolutely.
And I think it's
absolutely.
You know, I think you're right. You know, I think you're absolutely right. It's okay to paint. It's okay to composite. You know, I think this is interesting. I had a podcast that I recorded recently. It's not out yet, but it will be out soon with my friend Estres Varagnola, who's over at he was at Pixar, and he was like, it took years to convince Pixar that they could composite something.
Right.
Because they would the highlight is not right there, re-render everything. I was like, you know,
well, they can spend that money. I mean,
yeah, I guess, well, but it's just, well, I don't know. I just think it's a little different, but I think it's fascinating. You know, what you're doing. So now that you've done what you've done, and, you know, and Tim has done what he's done and proven that after years and years of convincing people now that we've done Love, Death, and Robots, and that's happened. Do you feel that the world of animation is going to has new opportunities and new types of content? And what would you like to see happen in that world?
Yeah, I mean, it is happening. The only thing is that animation, unfortunately, takes a while. So the things that we are doing now is going to take a while to watch. That's the only problem. But I mean, all the networks, they most of the networks, they have like an adult a site that is as big as the children now. Everybody's looking into that. Like, I'm constantly having meetings and talking to people, and everybody's interested about how adult is this and how cool it can be. Like, it's right now we are in a place that actually 2 years ago it was impossible. Like, 2 years ago you cannot go to a network and say, or 3 years ago you cannot go to a network and say, hey, I have this cool animation film, there is cocaine in there, there is like guns, there is shootings, cool, let's do it, you know. And it's gonna happen.
It did exist in Western culture, but it was very small and very niche, right? So there was Cartoon Network, right? They used to be their session that they did after hours, right? So it was after 10 o'clock or whatever. They called it Adult Swim, right? And Adult Swim was definitely for adults, right?
Yeah, but that's comedy. It's different.
That was humor. It was comedy. And that's what I was trying to get at. Comedy somehow. Yeah, because obviously Family Guy is not geared for kids,
or
right?
Simpsons, right?
So what is the distinction? You think comedy, but drama is the thing that was suddenly was not allowed, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, fiction in general that is not adventures or fantasy for kids is the thing that it hasn't been explored. Anything that is comedic, like, you know, you have feature film of South Park years ago. You have, I don't remember the name of this other movie. Also, the South Park people did it with the toys.
Oh, the puppets.
Yeah, exactly. So you can have those very
Team America, is that what it was?
Super extreme, funny, good writing. But it was always with the comedy thing, you know, like I'm personally, comedy is probably the most difficult thing. I think that comedy is super, super difficult. But what I'm saying is that in animation, we didn't explore drama. We haven't explored fully like drama, horror, thriller, you know, any kind of film that is not necessarily need to have fantasy levels or pets or shit like that. And not only that, with decent and good budgets, because that's also very important. You could always have people doing independent film, killing themselves for no money, and then all of a sudden they do a movie that it kind of like opens in Cannes, for example, or in Venice, or in a very niche festival. But now we have people willing to put money on it, you know, decent budgets. They are, and that's where we can all win.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. And I also think that the streaming networks are helping as well right now.
Yeah.
Because the streaming networks are making it that they don't feel they feel like they can provide a content that goes in a bucket, and then when people want to drink from that bucket, they can drink whenever they want, right? They don't have to sit there and worry about what time slot on, you know, are they going to be airing this or whatever, you know what I mean? Or how many people are going to go to the movie theater to see this? It's a very different approach to things. And I think it's successful because when especially with that type of content, that you have to be ready to digest it. You know, you have to be like, okay, I'm ready to see this content. When you do it on your own time and on your own, choices, that is very powerful. And I think you have a lot of content that are doing it. And I'm seeing it more and more. What was the, did you see, Undone on, I think it's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, no. I haven't seen, like, I barely have time for do anything else.
I know. But I was thinking of you when I saw that, because there was a lot of very similar concepts and ideas that were going on into Undone. And again, that is an animation done much more like Scanner Darkly.
Yeah,
so it's much more
I saw
animation.
I mean, I saw some of the trailer and the videos.
The style,
It looks very amazing, and the story looks very interesting.
And all the backgrounds were oil paintings.
I know. I heard about that.
I think it was really, you know, beautiful to think about that stuff, and that these content is possible, and these stories are possible. It was also interesting when I saw that is, then it becomes a question: well, why bother with animation, right? But what was really cool about that one, and it's similar to what you did in The Witness, is that you can make a visual that is richer, right, and more interesting. And I think that styles are much better to interpret in animation because you can draw it and you can literally represent that drawing as an animation, as opposed to here's a drawing, now recreate that in live action. It doesn't always translate as well as the drawing does, right?
Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, historically, painting has been much longer than real image. I mean, the cinema and photography, very much they have like a century, it's a century years old, right? But we've been used to see painting and depiction of reality in a graphic way, painterly, from even the caves to all the medieval paintings, the Renaissance. And up to the modern painting. So I think that humans, they are carving for graphic representations. It's just that because photography and video and film, it was sort of like a new thing. Everything went into that direction. But I think that we can mix both, and humans, probably they are happy to see painting back into the screens and how we can put it there. It's so cool how animation is a mix of every single art. If you think about it, there is no art that is out there that is not in a movie. There is like, it's drawing, painting, writing, and storytelling, acting, music. Nowadays with 3D, you have also sculpturing and you know, like modeling.
Every fine art is represented in
one 5 minutes piece to 80 minutes piece to 300 minutes TV show is every single art is there, and a lot of artists. So I think it's such a crafted medium. I love it the most. If people tell me like, well, you prefer painting or animation, I would say animation 100%.
Because you still get to paint.
I still get to paint, plus I tell stories, and you know, I don't have to think about, let's just do one piece and you just leave it there, you know?
So you mentioned earlier, it's like you would love to make a piece that's an animation that would be considered for best picture as an Oscar, right?
Any festival.
I understand. I'm just saying that as an example, though, right? Because that makes an impression. But what kind of story would you like?
Well, I have several. I'm actually. Funny, like I'm right now is the time, and everybody is kind of like contact, and I'm having a lot of conversations about it, and I'm in the works of actually three feature films right now, which I'm working on the stories and writing, and I guess that says that I cannot talk about it.
Yeah, I know you can't
but
talk
what
about
sort of story?
It. You can't
okay.
talk about it. But let's talk. Tell. Like, let's say, what's the genre? What's the thing that most compels you? What's the thing that drives you to write? You know, what kind of stories?
Well, I would say that the films that maybe I love, I obviously love. If you, for example, say Blade Runner, what I like about Blade Runner, for example, apart from aesthetically the world, I'm not saying that I want to do that, okay, but I'm saying like if the films that I like from Blade Runner, for example French cinema, I was just recently checking very obsessed about a lot of relationship, Eric Rohmer, I don't know if I am pronouncing it well, Eric Romero. It's like it's so. If you say these two films, anything in the middle, I like. But for example, what I really like about Blade Runner is the humanity on that film, right? Like how human it is and how deep it is. You take all the science fiction away, which I like it, but you take the science fiction away, and the thing that I like the best is the human part. And that's what I feel that a lot of films are lacking now. They are lacking of humanity. They are lacking of, because everything is about a hero. Everything is about a guy that is able to, you know, save the world. And those usually, you know, like I feel that they don't connect as much with myself as the story of a person that perhaps is a loser, or instead of a superhero, is a super loser. Things like that, they usually are more interesting for me. And that's the stories that I would like to tell. I would like to make films that they are more about human relationships or human struggling within the context of action, within the context of science fiction, whatever, you know, but it needs to be a nice, pure human element.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I think it's interesting, but I also think it's great that you're looking at, you know, when you're considering your animation and you're considering your stories, you are getting inspired by live action.
100%. Right? Yes.
Or movies that would traditionally be live action. And I think that if you continue to, with the idea of creating an animation that could have been live action, and then instead you gave it another level of personality through animation, is actually
100%. Really, yeah, I mean, imagine that you do Trainspotting in animation; it could be pretty fun,
right? Why not?
And right now we are in that situation. In fact, that a lot of the meetings that I'm having, and when I'm talking with the networks and people, they are sending me scripts for a while. They are sending me something that it's funny because usually they send me stuff that it has something from Hong Kong. Because I did The Witness, and something that has fantasy because it's animation, and it takes a while to tell the people, like, no, just send me any script that is good, a good writing that is meant to be for a live action. Like, I'll do it in animation, I interpret it in animation, but I want to see something that is not meant to be for animation. I want to read that kind of thing, and that's what I'm trying to do.
I think it's hilarious, because what you're doing is you're reverse Disneying this again, because Disney right now is doing all these animations and making live action versions of them, and what you want
to do actually
is take something that's the absolute opposite. You want to take something that's meant for live action and turn that
absolutely
into animation. And I think that's wonderful.
Absolutely, that's wonderful. What I mean, that's my driving right now, and basically my dream, which is kind of like happening, which is great.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I think this is really cool. I think that you're going to be, I know you are already very successful. I can't wait to see how you're going to be able to change the face of animation. I know that you've already done that in many ways. And I'm very excited about the world of animation, because people like you are pushing the boundaries of what people expect in that world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing that. Yeah. Thanks for doing that. Listen, we're gonna end it here, but I want to, if possible, I want you to stay on, because I have to. The audio has to upload, so I'll just keep you on. But anyway, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate a lot of your time as well, because you know it's nice to reach out of people in any way, and I think it's nice to educate the audience as well and to tell them that there is other ways of doing it, and if it's through podcast or if it's through any sort of like media, is like, yeah, let's do it for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I agree. And I'm really glad we were able to do this with you.
Cool.
So thank you.
Thank you so much.